So good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this webinar on the new NATO strategic concept. How could the alliance be better prepared for future challenges? So a very warm welcome, I'm afraid, in my case, from a very wet London. This webinar has been arranged by the London School of Economics Ideas, the New Strategy Centre in Bucharest, the Elcano Royal Institute in Madrid, and the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs, NUPI, in Oslo. My name is Peter Watkins. I'm now a visiting senior fellow with LSC Ideas, but I was previously, from 2014 to 2018, the policy director in the British Ministry of Defence. I will make some opening remarks to set the scene for our webinar today, and then I'm going to hand over to Dr. Antonia Colibisanu of the New Strategy Centre, who will chair an expert panel discussion. Dr. Powell and Dr. Fries will then draw the proceedings to a close. As is well known, the mandate to develop a new strategic concept was agreed by the NATO summit in June of this year, following the recommendation of the Reflection Group published about this time last year. The new strategic concept is expected to be adopted by the Madrid summit on the 29th, 30th of June next year. It will replace the existing document adopted 11 years ago in November 2010. Well, in fact, yes. The Secretary General, the current Secretary General, has said, quote, "The Madrid strategic concept will reflect the new security environment, recommit to our values, and reaffirm our unity, ensuring that our alliance is fit for the future," end of quote. In my time as policy director for the UK Ministry of Defence, there was a rumbling debate from 2014 onwards about whether to develop a new strategic concept. This was obviously prompted by the dramatic changes in the European security environment after the Russian intervention in Ukraine in March 2014. Personally, I was rather sceptical about undertaking such an effort. It seemed to me that the three core tasks set out in the existing document, collective defence, crisis management, and cooperative security, were still valid, as was the language on defence and deterrence. I felt that the alliance should focus its efforts on implementing practical measures to enhance deterrence, such as enhanced forward presence in the Baltic states and Poland. In the intervening few years, I accept that the pendulum has swung clearly in favour of developing a new strategic concept. The references to Russia in the existing document clearly need updating, and the absence of any reference to China looks decidedly odd in current circumstances. Indeed, even in the relatively short period since June, the security environment has deteriorated, and relations within the alliance have arguably become more challenging. I would note just the following. The new Russian military buildup around Ukraine and the growing fear and speculation of another conflict in Ukraine early next year. China's increasingly aggressive stance towards Taiwan, which has been apparent over recent months. And of course, China's testing of hypersonic missiles, described by the US chairman of the Joint Chiefs as, quote, almost a Sputnik moment, unquote. Then there's the withdrawal from Afghanistan and the unease within the alliance at the US's approach to that process. An approach which rather deflated expectations of a much more constructive stance towards allies and partners under the Biden administration, with many allies feeling that their concerns had not been sufficiently taken into account. And then, of course, the announcement of the Australia-United Kingdom-US agreement, the AUKUS agreement, in September. At one level, a firm recommitment by the United States to two traditional allies, but at another level, causing deep anguish in another ally, namely France. And then, perhaps a bit controversially, the agreement between France and Greece not so long ago, the mutual defense agreement, which looks as if it's a case of NATO countries providing security guarantees vis-a-vis other NATO countries. Drafting a new strategic concept will not in itself deal with any of these challenges, but it can provide a framework and impetus for planning and for tangible steps forward. We will all have our own priority lists, and I'm sure that they will come out in the discussion that Dr. Antonia is about to chair. But mine are, just to put them on the table, and you can all then disagree with them, I think NATO needs to reinforce its collective defence posture in the light of the threats and risks that we're now seeing. Secondly, it, or rather perhaps the relevant member states, need to do more to strengthen the European pillar of the alliance. In my view, and this is a personal view, NATO is still too dependent on the US. As the US needs to focus more and more on the Indo-Pacific, that dependency will start to raise questions about the credibility of NATO's deterrence posture. Thirdly, I think NATO should recognize that China is not only a systemic threat, to use the language as described by the EU, but potentially a strategic one. China may not pose an overt military threat in the Euro-Atlantic area, but it has made no secret of its desire to be a dominant player technologically. NATO could be a forum complementary to the EU for technological cooperation between the alliance and between members of the alliance and between them and partner countries, including perhaps Australia and Japan. Finally, I suggest that NATO needs to encourage its members to enhance their resilience, not only to so-called gray zone threats like disinformation and cyber attacks, but also wider hazards, including from accelerating climate change. The 2010 strategic concept was agreed in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis and its economic impact, which was still unfolding at the time. There was considerable uncertainty at that moment, but the geopolitical situation looked broadly stable, although that was not to prove to be the case for very long. The uncertainty and instability in the security environment this time round is much more palpable. And that, I would suggest, has to be the starting point for the new strategic concept. So that's all I was going to say by way of opening remarks. I suggest now that we move to you, Dr. Antonia, and you can open the first panel. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Watkins. And indeed, it is a pleasure to be with you today. Good afternoon, everyone. And it is an honor to actually opening a discussion of such distinguished guests and experts, actually covering defense policy, diplomacy, and obviously having extensive academic work done on the topic, which is of first importance today. Considering everything going on, as you have pointed out in the opening remarks. So with no further ado, I would like to invite Mr. Tom McCain, who is a visiting fellow with the London School of Economics and distinguished fellow of RUSI as well, and has had an interesting and long experience on defense matters in the UK MOD. You have the floor, sir.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for that introduction. Given that I was Peter Watkins' predecessor as the policy director in the UK Ministry of Defence, it perhaps won't come as a huge surprise that Peter's list of things that the new strategic concept needs to address won't be entirely dissimilar from my own, although I've got, I think, some slightly different takes on the questions. I agree with Peter that it would have been bizarre for the alliance to proceed further into the 2020s without a refreshed strategic concept, if only, as Peter said, to revise the completely outdated language on Russia that the 2010 document contains. But we would be wise, I think, not to expect too much from the document that will appear, we're told, in June, because these documents, by their nature, do tend to get driven down towards some kind of lowest common denominator in order to accommodate the views of the 30 allies, including, but not only, the rather different perspectives of those who tend to look south across the Mediterranean and those who tend to look more to the north and the east when they're thinking about their security. But even if the document itself does turn out to be somewhat bland, let's hope that the allies do take this opportunity to debate some of these fundamental challenges that that the alliance faces. And in addition, that they put in place some effective mechanisms to implement whatever they agree needs to be done in order to get to the destination described by the reflection group, NATO 2030, United for a New Era. So here are my suggestions of some issues that the alliance's leaders need to address. First, given the focus on strengthening the political dimension of the alliance, the allies need to have a really thorough debate about what they mean by this and what needs to be done to give it effect. Peter has already referred to the confusion over the withdrawal from Kabul. And I think looking ahead, a good test will be the extent to which President Biden consults his allies on the outcome of the US nuclear posture review, in particular the question of sole purpose or no first use. But the allies too will need to keep a focus on NATO EU cooperation and try to find some way to settle the respective roles of these two organizations. And also decide how best to handle difficult allies, including, but not only, Turkey. And I'd be interested to hear from Romanian colleagues in particular on the best way for preventing allies from drifting into other spheres of influence while sustaining the values that the alliance subscribes to. I guess that in relation to Russia, the strategic concept will talk in terms of deterrence, but also dialogue. But behind closed doors, the allies should have a frank discussion on how they can enhance deterrence. And I very much agree with Peter that this needs to be a major focus of the new concept. How they can enhance deterrence in the light of President Putin's increasingly threatening behavior. And this should include discussion of how much larger a forward presence, a forward deployment of troops should be made, given the logistical difficulties of rapidly reinforcing towards the east of the alliance's territory. But they should also have a frank discussion of how far and in what directions the alliance should continue to expand. And this should include a hard-nosed assessment of whether the inclusion of new members can contribute to common security and stability, to use the language of the 2010 strategic concept. And if the answer is no, we should avoid language which continues to imply something different. And this should be part and parcel of what the Reflection Group's report called NATO's role as a preventative tool to shape the environment rather than primarily as an instrument for managing crises once they've already broken out. And in my view, this should include a pretty fundamental consideration of the question of how to reduce the motivation for bad behavior on the part of adversaries and competitors without falling into the trap of appeasing them. In relation to China, I agree with Peter that the concept will have to say something about how to deter Chinese activity which undermines alliance security. But I hope that the alliance avoids trying to develop an Indo-Pacific strategy of its own and maintains its focus in Europe. A big question in relation to China, although it also applies to Russia, is the extent to which it's possible to continue to cooperate in some fields, such as climate change, nuclear non-proliferation, and counter-terrorism, while competing elsewhere. While we should certainly be trying to do this, it is going to be hard, I think, as we move forward, to avoid questions of linkage and ride these two horses simultaneously. I think that the alliance, and this is particularly true in relation to China, but it is also more generally true that the alliance should place more emphasis on the role of the economy in shoring up security, an aspect which has been relatively neglected by the alliance in recent times. And my fourth thought is that when it comes to the development of new capabilities, rather than focusing on the 2% of GDP figure, there should be some statements on the types of capabilities and structures that the alliance needs to build up in order to fulfill its collective defense mission. I mean, I would include some reappraisal of the purpose and ambition of the European phased adaptive approach, the ballistic missile defense system, and how to avoid an arms race, a new arms race in this area. And more generally, as part of a way to promote greater alliance cohesion, I would favor a larger common fund to use on capabilities which are most cost-effectively procured on a cross-alliance basis. I know this would be unpopular with both UK and French governments. They've tended to argue in the past that this would simply encourage free riders, but I don't think this is necessarily the case. The funds could also be used to assist poorer allies to put in place any resilience measures that are regarded as important for collective defence, though this might be something that it's more appropriate for the EU to lead on. Lastly, whatever else it does, the new strategic concept needs to demonstrate alliance cohesion and solidarity. Because if it can't do that, then we will go backwards rather than forwards.
Thank you. On that thought of cohesion and solidarity, you've raised important points going from challenges within the alliance, basically continuing the questions that have been raised in the opening remarks, and going forward with questions on how we can increase deterrence and how should we deal with China. So considering these challenges, I'd like to give the floor to Mr. Charles Powell now, who is director of the Elcano Institute and has a vast experience of analysis and academia, actually, in dealing with defense and security topics in NATO. Mr. Powell, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Antonia. And it's wonderful to be here sharing my thoughts on the future of NATO and the strategic concept with so many good friends and colleagues. So quite a lot has already been said in those introductory remarks, and I'm going to try to avoid repetitions, and I think I broadly agree with much of what's been said. Going very briefly back to the 2010 strategic concept, although I fully agree with what Tom was saying about not raising expectations unrealistically, I think if we look back at that concept, it was actually a rather underwhelming document in many ways, probably because at the time we didn't really see any major threats on the horizon. The Euro-Atlantic area was said to be at peace. Russia was said to be a potential strategic partner, and China didn't even deserve mention. So I think one of the difficulties NATO faced in 2010 was this absence of a widely perceived threat. And this, of course, has changed. So whether or not we think that we have the Chinese and the Russians to thank for this, at least we now have a sense of focus, which we didn't have before. Very quickly, let me just refer to some of the dilemmas or some of the problems, that the pitfalls that I see on the horizon as far as the what we will hopefully one day call the Madrid strategic concept. The basic dilemma, I suppose, is whether we go narrow and deep or broad and shallow. And this, of course, is a dilemma that faces a lot of strategic documents. I've tried my hand at the European Global Strategy document a few years ago, and this, of course, was one of the biggest problems we faced. And in connection with this, of course, we have several temptations. The most obvious in my mind is the temptation of going global and therefore moving away from the Euro-Atlantic space. Going global essentially to remain relevant and to seem ambitious, I suppose. Secondly, the temptation of lengthening the list of core tasks, again, to give the impression of ambition and capacity, which may actually hide deeper issues, deeper problems. Thirdly, and this I know is controversial, the temptation to act on the promise to make NATO a bulwark of the liberal democratic ideal in keeping with the pledge in Article 2. Remember, NATO in 1949 committed itself to a strengthening of free institutions. And I think President Biden may push us in this direction. Now, I'm not against reaffirming NATO's commitment to our fundamental values, but this, again, may generate expectations which we are later unable to meet in terms of global governance. And finally, perhaps the need that we may succumb to the temptation of defining a more compelling values-based narrative, which is part and parcel of what I was just mentioning now. And of course, this is understandable. After all, a strategic concept is an instrument of public diplomacy. It has many different audiences. It has internal NATO audiences, but also external ones. And of course, it's aimed at experts, but also at public opinion more generally. And so my main fear at the moment is that all of this may lead to an absence of clarity and to mission drift, and this absence of clarity, I think, was already present in the 2010 strategy. Now, at the risk of oversimplifying, what is the biggest challenge? I think the introductory remarks implied this, but I'd like to tease out some of the consequences. I think the the biggest challenge is that NATO essentially faces two major threats, which are very different in nature. The first threat is the rise of China, which of course poses a direct challenge to the role and the standing of the US in the world in military, economic, and political terms, and of course to the liberal international order that we all subscribe to. But at the same time, we have Russian assertiveness, the second major challenge, which is seen as an existential threat by some member states and by a rather distant prospect by other member states, Spain included, for example. And to my mind, the biggest question is, how can NATO deal with both? How can the strategic concept deal with both? And of course, the fear, which is an understandable one, is that if NATO fails to respond to this China challenge, which obsesses the United States at the moment, the US will disengage and will fuel fears that already exist and doubts about its future willingness to defend Europe from Russian aggression. This is a very real fear, I think, in countries such as Romania, as I saw for myself back in June, July, when I was in Bucharest at another NSC event. In other words, so one of the things, one of the question marks, one of the doubts that this document will have to dispel is, how strong is the US commitment to collective defense? And in connection with this, therefore, getting the best US-Europe burden-sharing balance is key, I think, defining how the United States and its European allies are going to share these burdens in future will be crucial. I'm not going to go into the Chinese issue, but I think it's very important that we should be aware of the fact that if we understand the concept to be a public diplomacy exercise, then we need to do a much better job at defining and explaining the nature of this challenge threat. The nature of the Soviet threat during the Cold War did not need explaining. It was self-evident. But many Europeans, citizens of NATO, European NATO states, member states, do not quite see the Chinese challenge or threat as clearly as North Americans do. Consequently, I think it's also going to be very important for the concept to prioritize collective defense. And obviously, there needs to be a formal recognition in the concept that deterring Russia is still a key NATO task, if not the key NATO task, and therefore there will have to be a very strong reaffirmation of the validity of Article 5. And obviously NATO will continue to take the lead in collective defense with the European Union in a supporting role. And this, of course, leads me to the another big problem, which I see on the horizon here, which is how to deal with some of the hopes, the aspirations emerging from or related to the European Union's strategic autonomy concept. Obviously, strategic autonomy will not extend to planning for territorial defense, but European NATO allies must build up their conventional forces to act as an effective deterrent, as has already been said. My friend Sven Biskop, I think, has a very nice little trilogy of sort of principles to guide EU-NATO collaboration. The first is that we must ensure that everything is done by the one who does it best. The second is that we must ensure that nothing is done twice. And the third, we must ensure that nothing is left undone. These three ideas may seem very obvious, but I think they are nevertheless extremely relevant to this debate. Let me just finally conclude with a few quick remarks about some of the concepts and some of the debates that we've been having over the last few months and years, which the concept will have to address. The first is what to do with emerging disruptive technologies, EDTs, and how to make Western industries cooperate, share technologies, and indeed innovate better. NATO already has some instruments in this field, like the NATO Artificial Intelligence Strategy or the Defense Innovation Accelerator for the North Atlantic, with that wonderful acronym DIANA. And of course, there is a new innovation fund as well that was adopted earlier to encourage investment in dual use technologies. Now, the question here, to my mind, is how far can NATO continue to advance along this road? Above all, how can NATO engage with private sector communities where innovation is actually taking place? I think this is the key question. Obviously, NATO can define the gold standard for military technology and can set, for example, interoperability standards for EDTs. But the question this leads me to ask, of course, is to what extent is this going to be compatible with strategic autonomy? Secondly, very quickly, resilience. I think this is a concept which we need to be a little bit more precise about, perhaps by tying it to the notion of collective defense. The strategic concept will probably acknowledge that cyber attacks can fall under the Article 2 or can trigger Article 5, the use of Article 5. But in many cases, it's the EU, I think, that should take the lead in building resilience in non-military threats in the field of subversion and coercion, for example. And finally, partnerships, the question of partnerships, which I think we should be linked more closely to cooperative security. We need to redefine, I think, and reevaluate what we expect of these partnerships. The partnership with the EU, of course, is crucial. That goes without saying. But in the same way that NATO is diverse, our partners are diverse. And I like this idea proposed by an author recently, who divided our partners into advanced, enhanced, and worldwide. The advanced partners being our European partners, such as Switzerland, Finland, and Sweden. Our enhanced partners being Western Balkan states and others in Eastern Europe. And finally, worldwide partners, both in the southern periphery and also in Asia Pacific, Japan, Korea, Australia, and New Zealand, most obviously. And a very final footnote about NATO in the South, since I'm speaking to you from Madrid. I think on the whole, the EU is better equipped, the EU's toolbox is better equipped to deal with the kinds of challenges that we're facing in the South. And more specifically, I would like to make a proposal. It's not entirely original, but as you know, NATO has built a southern hub, which is attached to its applied to the Naples Joint Force Command, and it would probably make sense to hand over control of this to the EU, or at least to Southern European actors that are more directly involved in the region. Thank you very much. I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much, Mr. Paul. And I'm not going to repeat everything as a complimentary question that you put, because you put a lot of questions. You asked a lot of questions at the end, very, very reasonable questions, I would say, for the future of NATO, not only for the NATO strategic concept. I would like to give the floor now to our third distinguished expert, Mr. Ambassador Cristian Diaconescu, member of the Scientific Council of the New Strategy Center and former Minister of Foreign Affairs from Romania, by reminding him that Romania was mentioned a few times in the discourse already with regards to our position towards Turkey's role in NATO, and obviously a lot more that we have to say regarding resilience and deterrence in the neighborhood. Mr. Diaconescu?
good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me here. And I'm extremely happy and honored to take part in this panel and to address such an important issue for present and future of us and our families and our nations about the new strategic concept of NATO, about our defense. Well, from my former lives in different institutions, I remember that it was a quite interesting discussion within the NATO institutions, and not only about the concept of 360-degree alliance. Meaning NATO officials, in many respects, often use, when referring to the ability of the alliance to deal with threats coming from various directions, this type of attitude. If my recollection is correct, on June 2015, halfway between NATO Newport and Warsaw summits, amidst tensions with Russia on the eastern flank, growing terrorist threats from ISIS and the migration crisis on the southern flank, NATO defense ministers reminded us, and allow me to quote, to address all these challenges to the east and to the south, NATO continues to provide the 360-degree approach to deter threats and, if necessary, defend allies against any adversary. Well, given the recent deployment of the Russian Federation's military troops near the Ukrainian border, its naval display of power in the Black Sea, and its aggressive posturing against NATO member states, it would seem to me that the security of the eastern flank should be on the top of the NATO's agenda in 2022. Yet the question remains whether NATO, in this time of the COVID-19 pandemic, will be able to formulate clear, coherent, a policy towards Russia, while upholding, of course, the core objectives of deterrence and defense. But my best guess is that it is time to refocus NATO's efforts towards the eastern flank. Well, in this respect, I remember something. Bulgarian ambassador to the United States has said in a certain moment, what happens in the Black Sea doesn't stay in the Black Sea. Well, the Black Sea region is where Russia, Europe, and the Middle East, the Balkans, and the Caucasus come together. Is the region in the center of four great forces: democracy on its western edge, Russian military deployments to its north, Chinese financial interference to its east, instability in the Middle East to its south. So the Black Sea region seemed to be a frontier between the free world, liberal democracy, and autocratic regimes. Great power competition in this region since many, many years ago prevented great power conflict. Failure to compete and to demonstrate and protect interests in all domains can lead to power vacuums and misunderstanding. At least from my point of view, they can turn and lead to an escalation of tensions and actual conflict. Well, it was mentioned here about European Union. Yes, it is important. Of course, there will be a very significant step forward how the solidarity and the coherence of the Europeans with regard to the future of NATO will be addressed. What we can say is that after significant steps from 2016 onward, as I remember, the European Union has begun to face a number of hurdles that threatened to undo earlier progress on the defense portfolio. Four obstacles are very frequently mentioned in European chancelleries. One of them is the difficulty of defining strategic autonomy as a narrative for the European political project. Second, the European Union lack of accountability and transparency in defense matters. Reductions in European defense funding is happening, fortunately not in my country. And most recently, the coronavirus pandemic. So it becomes increasingly clear that NATO needs to rethink its role in the shifting world order together with the Europeans. But as Europeans become more aware of their weaknesses, it is high time for the European Union to be clear about its common interests and values and how best to protect them. In this respect, I can tell you, of course, I'm extremely happy and ready to be contradicted and someone to say the opposite. In this respect, practically the concept of European strategic autonomy in defense has become both popular and controversial in recent years. Broadly speaking, this concept is commonly understood as the capacity to act and cooperate with partners whenever possible, while being able to operate independently whenever it is necessary. So there are no ready-made blueprints for your Atlantic security and defense policy. The Europeans still are confronted with quite sensitive dilemmas, how to enhance European sovereignty in defense, despite lackluster political and financial commitments, how to help generate a common European Union strategic culture amid diverging national threat perceptions. You know, very well, it's a difference when speaking about the threat coming from migrants, respectively in central and western part of European Union, and the threat coming from the proximity of the eastern frontier of European Union in Poland, the Baltic states, Romania, or Bulgaria. How to ensure transparency and accountability in security and defense matters, and how to address capability dependencies on the United States. Of course, the Europeans should take their life in their hands. And from this respect, I think that the new political Euro-Atlantic security concept will legitimate this international issues test, the collective capacity to respond to internal and external challenges. This project can succeed as long as it retains the hallmarks of what made the European Union great, and not only the Euro-Atlantic space great, the protection of democratic principles and the promotion of peace and internally and abroad. I should like not to conclude before saying something. Unlike in the Baltics, immediately after the invasion of Ukraine, no NATO battle groups have been deployed to the region or NATO command structure put in place to rebuild deterrence in the Black Sea region. Instead, NATO in the Black Sea region provided a tailored forward presence. Distinguished panelists, distinguished colleagues, it's a difference. It's a difference in our language, not particular in what the others who are looking to NATO from unfriendly positions are trying to have an interpretation about our decision. This difference should disappear. Like the Nordic-Baltic region, the complex political and history of the Black Sea region, yes, it is a difficult one to develop either a regional or a NATO approach to strengthen deterrence, but we should not stay away from this issue. Well, as you know, in the Black Sea region, we have three NATO allies, Bulgaria, Romania, and Turkey, two NATO partners, Ukraine and Georgia, and also Russia. So Turkey and Romania host two critical elements of NATO's deployed missile defense system that really protects both Europe and the United States. I was working to the strategic partnership between Romania and Turkey. It was Ahmet Davutoğlu in that moment, my partner in the dialogue was Minister of Foreign Affairs. And I can tell you that we should have a certain type of plan, attitude, taking into account that Turkey has a specific role in the Black Sea. When I'm speaking about deterrence, military balance, the capability of influencing dialogue and cooperation within the countries in the region. Yes, it is difficult, extremely difficult, but we should not lose the courage and the determination from this point of view. Of course, I can enter in details from this perspective, but if the main idea I mentioned here about how we can rebalance the Black Sea region security plan, having a priority and completion of upgrading the tailored forward presence in the region, I think we cannot exclude Turkey in any way from this endeavor in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. And now that we had your very interesting claims about European strategic autonomy and how to build European strategic defense within the EU, but also outside the EU, I'd like to invite the next distinguished guest, Dr. Carsten Friis, the head of research group on security and defense from Norway, the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs, to give us a perspective on how you are seeing the future for NATO and NATO strategic concept that we are going to outline during the next summer. Sir?
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. And let me echo the other panelists and thank you for organizing this and inviting me. I think it's really great that we have speakers from all corners of Europe, as it were, east, west, north, south. Of course, being the last speaker, I have been frenetically reorganizing my notes, so I don't repeat too much what's been said already. So pardon me a little bit if I'm not, as eloquently streamlined in my notes as some of the other speakers were. So I try to highlight some issues that has not been talked about so much yet. First of all, let me just reaffirm my agreement with those of you who said that there is a need for an update of the strategic concept. Like think tankers and academics have wanted this for quite a long time, obviously, because that's the kind of things we like to talk about. But I guess the political realities, particularly in the United States, nobody wanted to touch this as long as President Trump was president. Let's be honest about that. And now there's a bit of opportunity for some years until he's back, maybe, or somebody like him. That has created, uncertainty within the alliance, and the more we can reaffirm the transatlantic relationship now, the better, I think, before we don't know what will happen next. I think that's important to note. I think it's also important to remember that President Macron's points on NATO being brain dead and the need for making NATO a forum for consultations. We're not really there yet. Referred to what was said by Peter Watkins and others to begin with. There's a potential there to enhance dialogue or use NATO as a forum for dialogue and consultations. Now, the three top core tasks are supposed to continue, I have been told. But as been stressed by the ambassadors and others, there's obviously that some are more equal than others. So these core tasks are not really the same. I mean, a collective defense is by far the most important one these days. So even if they continue, there's little doubt if you go to SHAPE or the military planners, that's what they spend their time on, is developing all the military plans. And there's a whole range of new acronyms that NATO geeks can learn, like the DDA and the SUSP and the SSP and GDRP and NWCC and you name it. These are all military plans that are meant to operationalize collective defense and basically making NATO ready to do what it was tasked to do back in 1949 to collect us, to collectively defend us from the threat from the east. And NATO has done a great job on that recently. And of course, much of this is classified. We don't know the details, but we know there's a lot of work done on it, and it's much better now than it was a few years ago. So let's not delude ourselves. This is absolutely the main task of NATO, what's been doing these years. Let me just give me a quick look at my notes now to see how I was. Yes, when it comes to collective defense and Russia, I guess we have the language more or less from the summits. I don't think there'll be much discussion on how to describe Russia, because that's been done several times in the last few years. But I see a the challenge related to the dialogue part, obviously, because there's no strategic dialogue with Russia anymore. But I think there should be some behind the scenes thinking about how to find ways to communicate. And maybe, in my view, we should find ways to enhance military to military dialogue with Russia, not to resolve the big questions, but to avoid unexpected escalations and misunderstandings, incident and sea kind of arrangements. I think more countries should need that, and we shouldn't be too formalistic about not having a Russian dialogue on a military level with Russia, if that's an obstacle, so to speak, to achieve that. Let me then move on. I think it was mentioned resilience. Resilience is an important word, although nobody knows what it means. But it means a lot of things, and it's from societal, the democratic, resilience that we can withstand political pressure to physical functionality of our computers. And obviously, there's an arena here for cooperation with the European Union, because NATO military depends on lots of the civilian infrastructure that NATO doesn't control and requires an EU cooperation to deal with that. And in the extension of that, I would like to stress also the EU, military mobility approach that it's doing, which is super important, that we still need to rely on that process within the European Union to succeed for able to move troops around Europe. It's very important. In general, though, and I think it's very also important that we, given the more complex security threat picture these days, that there is a strong collaboration with the European Union, and that this is also stressed wherever is appropriate in the strategic concept. And I like the Sven Biskup's the list from No Duplication and Leave Nothing Untouched. That's a good one, and I think that's a good guiding principle. And of course, as a country coming from a country which is non-EU member, duplications is of course our main concern. We don't want duplications. Let me also stress, though, I think the open door policy needs to be open. And maybe I don't disagree with Tom McCain there. I think it's important because that's our very basic principle that states decide their own foreign policy orientation. And we don't want these spheres of influence. We don't. That is what Russia wants. And that's our very basic principle difference between let's say, Russia and NATO. So we need to have that open. But we don't, of course, don't have to put in long-range missiles on Ukraine's territory. I mean there's a difference there between how we propose our principles and how we operate in practice. China obviously also has to be mentioned. I will not repeat it too much. I just want to say one kind of funny way of summarizing China and Russia, which I heard the other day, that Russia is bad weather and China is climate change. So we have a declining power and a rising power, and we have to deal with China, and it's obviously something we have to deal with for many years forward. And that leads me to my last point. This challenge of how generic such a strategic concept be, how general shall it be, and how specific shall it be? Because the more specific you are, the better it hits the reality today, but the less quicker it gets outdated. And vice versa, the more generic you make it, the longer it lasts, but it's less useful, perhaps. So I guess that is going to be the challenge of those people sitting in NATO headquarters and formulating these sentences that everybody's going to agree on, to finding that balance and drawing that, finding that right, making it relevant, but still not outdated in 2 years' time. So, Madam Chairman, I think I'll stop there and open for discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for pointing out the balancing act that everyone needs to do when the actual paper is being written and the words are being written down in the strategic concept. Indeed, that is also a challenge. So with no further ado, I'd like to first ask you, each one of you, if you have any remarks, responses, comments on what your colleagues have said so far before getting to questions that have been asked? No? Well, if no particular comments, then I will go right to questions, and I'll start reading from the questions box here. From Mr. Ewan Grant, London, former law enforcement intelligence analyst covering ex-Soviet states. How easy will it be for NATO to work with the EU central bodies, especially Commission and EAS, given that most staff there have worked in a non-security and defense working culture? Well, who wants to take that? Considering the balancing act, here is another one.
Could I say something about that?
Sure.
Oh, sorry, Tom raised his hand.
Oh, Tom.
No, I was going to raise something else, Charles. So why don't you go ahead and...
Yeah, well, I've quoted him before, but let me strongly recommend an article, again, by Sven Biskop of Egmont in Brussels. He has a very witty piece on EU-NATO relations, and he compares it to, it's called something like a concordat, a compass, and a concept. So the idea is that, you know, this is like concordats, which, as you know, are the agreements that bind the Catholic Church with Catholic countries, or predominantly Catholic countries. So what he's doing in this article is to compare NATO and the EU to religious organizations, which have their high priests, they have their religious scripts, they have, of course, their very well-defined priesthoods, and so on. So what am I getting at? What I'm getting at is that, you know, EU, NATO, admittedly, EU and NATO have very different administrative cultures, political cultures, if you like, for obvious historical reasons. But that, you know, is not no longer, I think, a serious obstacle to much closer EU-NATO cooperation. Not least, of course, because NATO has also moved very steadily into the non-military sphere. A lot of NATO policies, a lot of NATO concepts are actually, they actually pertain to the non-military sphere. And in some cases, in fact, you could argue that it's NATO that has invaded or moved into the space that was traditionally occupied by the EU, resilience being perhaps the best case in point. So to provide a very specific answer, no, I don't think that, you know, NATO will find it impossible to deal with the Commission or the External Action Service. Thank you.
Mr. McCain, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, let me, I mean, I'll just add a brief comment on that point and then raise something slightly different. I mean, I agree with Charles Powell about the fact that there's no fundamental difficulty in getting these two organizations to work together. I don't think it's the fact that many of the staff in the Commission have very different backgrounds from the staff in NATO. You could, in fact, possibly say that there's this big, if not a bigger, difference between the NATO international staff and the international military staff, who are sort of separated both geographically and culturally in many ways. And I think the biggest obstacle to even closer collaboration between the EU and NATO is the attitude of different political leaders of the members of these two these two different organizations. That's where the real problem lies. And if you want to get them to work better together, then the leaders themselves have to resolve that that's what they want to be done. I wanted to raise a question, really. I think it's probably Carsten but I'd be interested in anybody's views on this. I mean, I should say that when I mentioned spheres of influence, I didn't mean to imply that I approved of the concept. It was more just a shorthand way of talking about the subject. But since I think, Carsten, you were in favour of continued dialogue to the extent that that's possible with the Russian government, I'd be interested if there's anything additional that you can say about how you think that the tensions that are erupting between the Russian government and the West, if I can put it in that general term, can be managed more productively.
Should I answer that right away? Yeah.
I think that's best.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, that's a good question, Tom. Of course, I don't have a very easy. It's difficult because it takes two to tango, doesn't it? I think but my point is that I think on the political level, there are very limited dialogue right now, at least between NATO as a body. That doesn't prevent NATO countries from having bilateral dialogue with Russia where it can, and they should do so. And of course, the United States do so. That's the most important one. But others who can should continue to do so. If nothing else, if you don't want to resolve anything, at least you have a channel. My point was perhaps more on the military to military side. I mean, in Norway, we had this bilateral. We don't cooperate and you know do anything together, but at least we have a hotline, and we have just agreed on a new incident at sea agreement, updated one, which includes UAVs, for instance, drones. So, I mean, they are just an example, but and I don't have full overview of what different NATO countries have in this regard, or what NATO has and what exists out there, but I just think it's time to really make sure that we have as much mill-to-mill on an operational tactical level as well, if possible, you know, channels with Russia. So at least we can avoid misunderstandings. Again, that's not going to resolve the big question about the value differences between Russia and NATO, but at least it doesn't bring us down a path we don't want to go.
Thank you. And the next question is from Ambassador Sergei Chalak. Which should be the procurement and other spending priorities for effective European defense as a meaningful complement to NATO without unwanted overlap or duplication? I think this has been kind of touched earlier in your discourses. So who wants to get that one? And no one. We don't know, Mr. McCain.
Can you just repeat the question, just to make sure that I've got the point?
Sure. So the procurement and other spending, which should be the procurement and other spending priorities for effective European defense as a meaningful complement to NATO without unwanted overlap or duplication?
Okay. Well, I mean, look, the fundamental point to make is that it's not that there are a set of European defense capabilities and a set of NATO defense capabilities. We're talking about almost entirely, but not completely entirely, but almost entirely, we're talking about the same sets of defence forces which are organised and procured by the individual member states. I don't think that I would go along with the, you know, the premise of the question, But I do think that it's perfectly possible for the EU and NATO to develop further their understanding of the types of mission that each organization would be able to and willing to take on. And I mean, after all, they have already done a certain amount of that. And I think that inviting the EU to look more at missions in Africa, for example, makes plenty of sense. But as to capabilities, I don't really care myself whether new capabilities that are required by the for the defence of Europe are procured through EU organisations with EU funding, or are done through NATO. Although I think, just as a matter of fact, the EU has put more effort in recent years into enhancing its role in that area.
Thank you. Mr. Carson, Fris, do you want to add something to that, please?
If I may, I mean, if it's about this relationship between NATO and the European Union, which is, you know, much of these discussions is about the strategic autonomy and what does it mean and what does it not mean. And I think there's so much confusion out there, and it creates so much unnecessary tension, I think, across the pond, across the Atlantic, because the United States is concerned about what it means, and, you know, it's like, is it against us or whatever? I think it would be great if Paris and Washington can agree on a definition, so we all could relax. Because I don't think it. I think there's so much discussion on the linguistic meaning of it that you know, we waste energy on it, and I don't think it should be really difficult. You know, to find a way to define this term in a way that doesn't undermine NATO at all. It's just be continue where NATO ends, kind of definition. So that is, so again, it's just a more broader reflection around the topic that Ambassador Celoc is raising here. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Powell, do you want to add something?
Yes, I mean, I take Carsten's point that we shouldn't, you know, allow semantics to stand in the way of the fundamentals. But let me just mention a word that I think hasn't been raised today, and that's legitimacy. NATO has significantly increased its military spending from $250 billion in 2014 to $315 billion in 2020. Now, a lot of our citizens, you know, need to be reassured about this expenditure in the context of COVID or post-COVID or wherever the hell we are right now, sixth or seventh wave, depending on who's counting. You know, and let me just stress, this is an exercise in public diplomacy. We need to prove to our citizens that NATO is a good thing, that they're getting good value for money. And one of the problems we have in Spain, for example, is that if a politician tells Spaniards that defense spending has to increase, they are far less likely to accept it if the politician justifies this on the grounds of NATO membership than if he or she justifies it on the grounds of EU membership. Why? For the simple reason that most Spaniards, you know, identify very strongly with European integration, and they rather like the idea of strategic autonomy, even though most of them, of course, have no idea what it actually means. So, you know, what I'm saying is that we live in the real world, we live in a political world, and our politicians are not operating in a vacuum. So let's remember that the strategic concept has to be relevant to ordinary voters as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
If I may.
Sure.
Well, just a very short comment. Again, I'm coming back. I shall be boring in any time. I'm coming back to the Black Sea to tell you from our experience here, if you want seriously to counter and deter Russian activity in the Black Sea region, NATO, Europeans, United States need to develop a strategy that encompasses, at least from my point of view, not just military actions, but economic, political, and development assistance. Three Seas Initiative. Maybe it would be an initiative which should be considered much more serious to reduce the areas of economic and developmental weakness in the region. You know that there are NATO countries who are dealing very well with the problem of energy corridors nowadays when we are speaking. And one of the countries which is confronted with a certain type of deployment which might generate, I hope not, an aggression, Ukraine, is also aggressed coming from other directions in terms of energy and the corridors respectively. And there are NATO countries who are working in this regard. It is up to their interest beyond any doubt, but let's not avoid the reality and not place it respectively in only in an academic approach.
Thank you. And on to the next question. From Andreas Benke, if, as US intelligence expects, Russia creates a military fait accompli early next year, how would this affect this process and the formulation of a strategic concept? Well, who wants to take that? A fait accompli by Russia, since you ended with the Black Sea. There is a question for the okay, Mr. Carsten Fries.
Yes, it's a great question from Andreas, and let me first question some of the foundations there. I'm not sure about fait accompli will be the result of a Russian adventure into Ukraine, but that's another discussion. If there was to actually cross the borders with the tanks in a, let's say, old school warfare way, not using this plausible deniability approach that they have been doing this far, except in Crimea, it would be a radical change in European security, much more radical than what happened last time with Crimea. But it's difficult to say how it would impact the strategic concept. It would impact European security in a profound way that is, it's really difficult to predict, but it's going to be extremely serious. And we can discuss that as a seminar in itself, but for the question, I think it will only just reinforce the collective defense part of the core tasks further. And I guess the language on Russia would be even stronger than it already is today.
Thank you. I guess no one wants to add anything to that. So the next question from Hugh Dawson, what do the speakers see as NATO's main role regarding climate change? And another one from him as well, which I think is very much connected, does NATO have a role in preserving biodiversity? Well, climate change was okay. Mr. Paul, you take this.
Yes, I have hastened to raise my hand on this one because this is precisely what I was thinking of when I spoke earlier about expanding the list of core tasks endlessly. We have many other fora, the COP26, the ink is barely dry, the United Nations system. We have many other fora in which to discuss climate change. The European Union, of course, is extremely actively involved. So I think the only dimension of climate change, which is relevant to NATO, is how to make our armed forces more climate friendly. In other words, how to reduce their impact on the environment. But I don't think NATO should become actively involved in the fight against climate change as an international organization. Thank you.
from Simanov Egor, who is a student in St. Petersburg State University. He asked the following question. The 2010 concept failed to play a positive sum game with Russia in terms of security. What lesson can be learned and how it can be implemented in the new concept? Okay.
Well, let me just kick off. I think that the 2010 strategic concept was extremely positive about Russia. In fact, you know, some would argue that in the wake of the invasion of Georgia in 2008. It should have been tougher in its language. So as everybody, I think, said, we should expect the language in the new strategic concept to be much less accommodating towards Russia. And I cannot see it using language of partnership, given what is going on in the world.
Thank you. Anyone wants to add to that? We are having lots of questions, I have to say, and we'll have to go a bit over the board with them. So if no one wants to add anything to that, I'll just go to the next one. NATO should focus on resilience, but link it as closely as possible to collective defense. Thus, NATO can perhaps strengthen cooperation with counter-terrorism and counterintelligence. But the alliance should refrain from areas of ordinary law enforcement, such as weaponized corruption, outsourcing or of influence operations, and drug trafficking, as earlier proposed, among others, by Joseph Biden. So this is basically what should we give up while we're getting something else to fight with? This is a question from Henrik Larsen. Sorry, I haven't mentioned that. Does anyone of you want to?
I don't think it's a question. I think it's a statement.
Sort of a comment.
And I kind of agree with him as well.
Okay, Mr. Powell.
Yes, Henrik has actually written a very good article in which he discusses this issue at length, and I totally agree. Organizations like NATO and the EU should play to their strengths, not to their weaknesses. And very often, I'm more of a sort of EU person, I have to admit, but I, you know, what I often see or what I've seen in the last few years in NATO circles is experts and NATO officials desperately looking for new causes and possibly even looking to create new institutions which would duplicate things that already exist. And since the comment you've just mentioned refers to resilience, let me give you a very specific example. The Reflection Group suggests that we create a Center of Excellence for Democratic Resilience, right? But the EU and NATO already have a Center of Excellence for Countering Hybrid Threats. I know they're not the same thing, but, you know, frankly, creating new institutions and throwing money at problems that other institutions are already dealing with won't make those problems go away. Thank you.
Question from Macedonia: if the total elimination of nuclear weapons is part of the strategic concept of NATO, or in general, so what is the relation of NATO with nuclear weapons, basically?
Well, if nobody else wants to take that, I mean, NATO is a nuclear alliance, so that's it's a fundamental part of its strategy of deterrence, and it has been that really from the outset. So that doesn't imply an irresponsible relationship with nuclear weapons, but it means that all of the allies agree that that nuclear deterrence is an essential part of NATO's deterrence strategy.
Thank you. I'm instructed by the organizers to take two more questions, so I'll basically combine a few in one question. From Nicholas Ott, and a similar question was above, when you look at challenges in the emerging disruptive technology sector, do you see room from allies to agree on an ambitious agenda around strategic and ethnic perspectives of technology development? For example, around NATO's effort to be leading entity on normative frameworks or for the application for AI and military purposes, how can NATO best leverage the industry's expertise on these topics as Diana and other formats are not really covering the strategic aspects of emerging disruptive technologies? So it's both a comment and a question. Does anyone want to take that?
If I may.
Please.
I mean, that's a very good question, which I addressed very, very briefly. In normative terms, I think the European Union is better placed because of its competences, because of its role in guaranteeing competition in the internal market, in the single market, because of its normative power, generally speaking. And this is what I highlighted concerns me about this possible clash between NATO initiatives and strategic autonomy. So-called open strategic autonomy, as you know, this is how we are now meant to refer to it. And of course, the openness of the strategic autonomy has been included at the suggestion, for example, of the Netherlands, because they are concerned that strategic autonomy may actually lead to two things. First of all, protectionism, which is incompatible basically with the EU's internal market philosophy. And secondly, an excessive concentration of power in the hands of certain large companies and possibly certain member states in certain policy areas. And of course, defense is an obvious one. Are we going to have European champions, or are we going to have Franco-German champions dressed up as European champions? What's going to happen to the industry, to the defense industry in smaller member states? Some of which, of course, as you know, have very valuable defense industries, niche industry in certain niche sectors. So again, to conclude, I think very close EU-NATO cooperation is really the only way of leveraging the industry's expertise in this area. Thank you.
Sure. Mr. Frist, do you have anything?
Yeah, if I may add to what Mr. Powell said, I agree with that, but it's also transatlantic important here with the US tech industry being the leading one. But just to remind Mr. Ott that I think it was in the London meeting that was agreement about the EDT roadmap, if I remember correctly, with seven areas of cooperation. And NATO has since then developed this into EDT, that means emerging and disruptive technologies, one of these acronyms you have to learn if you're going to follow this. Follow NATO. So the EDT strategy has been developed since then, and I think there's also an AI strategy coming later on. So the point is that the NATO has already done quite a lot in this regard, and it means that there are some principles that the NATO allies can use, in their own national developments. So again, I don't have all the details here, but NATO do have a role to play, at least in some of the overarching strategic approaches to these questions.
Thank you. And a final question, and I thank you very much to everyone who has written in a question, by the way. So I'm going to combine now a few questions that we received on China and how NATO can take a role with regards to China, considering the economic strategic connection there. NATO faces two major challenges among other ones, a geopolitical one with Russia and the geopolitical, ideological, and systemic one with China. If hypothetically the red lines imposed by Russia would not be challenged by some NATO countries, how do the panelists see the possibility for Russia and NATO commencing a strategic dialogue that could evolve into a closer partnership able to deal with ultimately a common challenge for both entities, which is China, in the long term? There were a few that were also relating to NATO's interest, strategic interest, and its economic interest within the strategic framework. Mr. McCain?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an obvious question, one is bound to want to try to ensure that Russia and China's close cooperation doesn't become even closer and more threatening to the West. But I think all the evidence at the moment suggests that there is really no chance of convincing Russia that it ought to adopt a more cooperative attitude to the West in order to face up to China. Both of them are authoritarian regimes, and they see the world at the moment, at any rate, through similar pairs of spectacles.
Mr. Friss?
Yes, I agree with Tom there. Well, let me add, I mean, there are some, especially in the US, some writers, distinguished professors, who kind of arguing along these kind of lines that we should do this, we use, like, play the geopolitical chess game and draw a strategic, you know, find a good strategic platform together with Russia, because China is, as I said earlier, climate change, and therefore we need to kind of join forces. But I mean, that in principle means sacrificing Ukraine, to put it very bluntly. I mean, for the sake of some strategic long-term thing. I think it's chess, like, what's it called? Desk, is that strategy. It's kind of disconnected from the real world and completely disconnected from the values we have. So first of all, I don't think it's realistic. I don't think it's anything we should kind of try to argue in favor. And let me add also, I don't think actually Russia would like to dance too closely with China, because China is so much stronger. And we see it up north in the Arctic. This alleged collaboration between Russia and China up there is limited. I mean, they also have investment from France, from Total, in their LNG, for instance. They don't want to be completely dependent on China, because they want the national control themselves. So, I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Paul, do you want to add anything?
As a historian, which is basically what I still see myself as, I think the Russians haven't forgotten Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, and they're still smarting from the consequences of the opening to China. In other words, beware of these triangular games, because Russia has tended to lose out as a result. So as Tom was saying, I don't see any chance of trying to pit one against the other, or trying to encourage the Russians to be more friendly towards the West on account of their growing fear of China. I think, as has been said, the Russians are going to be disruptive and assertive regardless of what China is up to.
Mr. Ambassador, I've seen you unmuted earlier, so do you want to add something?
Oh, yes. Speaking from the reality of Europe. China has entered practically in Europe, not as a military power, not using particular hard power, but a soft power as a financial and economic one. They are taking advantage of the underdeveloped areas of Southern Europe, as you know. By the way, maybe a Marshall Plan for the Black Sea. Someone considered somewhere? They build infrastructure, the Chinese. They build ports, railroads with strings attached, of course. China's Belt and Road Initiative has practically penetrated the Black Sea and the Mediterranean regions from Turkey to Greece, into Italy, Egypt, and the Balkans. Now Chinese, they have trade and financial deals, and they have bought also the political leverage influencing decision even in the European Union. So the politics here is quite different and again, very complicated.
From a complicated topic to another one and a complicated ending of the Q&A sessions. Thank you very much for writing in questions and apologize for not having the time to take all questions in. But I would like to invite now for the concluding remarks, Dr. Charles Powell, and then Dr. Carsten Friss, so we can basically conclude the complication of complicating issues.
Well, thank you very much, Antonia. And let me just say again, what a pleasure it has been to share this panel with such excellent speakers. I just wanted to mention something that perhaps hasn't been stressed, and this is that, you know, there's a window of opportunity here. NATO is in the throes of producing its strategic concept. And of course, the EU is in the process of producing its compass, strategic compass. And these two efforts will be coming together in the spring of 2022. I'm not necessarily saying that, you know, NATO and EU have to work hand in hand, but I am saying that everything would appear to suggest that closer collaboration between these two organizations, whose membership happens to overlap to a very large measure, is going to be crucial, I think, in determining our ability to stand up to the two challenges that we've mainly been talking about this afternoon, namely the rise of China and what this means for the rules-based liberal international order and Russian assertiveness. So let us be optimistic. I want to finish on this optimistic note. There is a window of opportunity which we should try to take advantage of. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. So let me also be non-complex and brief. There's one dimension here and one let's say central actor that does not participate today, and that's of course the United States. The transatlantic relations and keeping United States in is of course the most important task internal task of NATO, to keep United States engaged. The challenge, I think, the main challenge will be how we as Europeans can remain relevant for the American security agenda, which is Asia and China, without necessarily sending our troops there, but still be relevant and not only be relevant in protecting Europe. I think this is going to be somewhat difficult and more difficult than it appears on the surface right now. So that is going to be what we need to follow in the years to come to maneuver that space. So with those words, I will say thank you again.
And thank you. It was quite a pleasure to chair this session. And thank you very much for everyone that turned on the webinar and listened and participated lively with us. Thank you very much.